listeners of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Friday, February 20th, 2015. An in-depth look at the unfolding crisis in the Ukraine as a peace deal reached last week remains unfulfilled. We'll speak with Ukraine expert Dr. David Marples live in studio. And acclaimed Mexican human rights activist and Catholic priest Alejandro Solalinde joins us to discuss Central American immigration and Mexico's challenges of poverty and violence. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Christina Mislan. She's an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. Hi, Christina.
Hello, Sonali.
So Germany formally rejected Greece's request for a six-month extension of its loan program yesterday. Under the new leadership of Alexis Tsipras, Greece requested the extension, saying that it offers more time to come to a compromise on the strict terms of the ongoing bailouts of the bankrupt nation. German officials, however, are adamant that social belt tightening is the only way for Greece to fulfill its debt obligations. At stake is Greece's possible exit from the eurozone. In fact, the German magazine Der Spiegel reported that the European Central Bank is already preparing for a Greek exit. This morning, news emerged that German authorities may be softening their tone, as Mr. Tsipras told press that he was confident that finance ministers of EU nations would accept his terms. Christina, do you think this battle between Germany and Greece is really about economic ideology rather than anything else, since a Greek victory could mean the beginning of the end of austerity in general?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think there's very little in this world that isn't about economic ideology and the consequences that emerge from that. I think in terms of Greece, there have been several economists and experts who have pointed out and highlighted the consequences of austerity measures in European nations like Greece, as well as the lack of monetary sovereignty. So those are all issues that Greece and Germany and the loan program right now that they have to deal with. But, you know, whether there was a Greek victory, whether it would be an end to austerity measures, I think that's, you know, that deserves a question mark. I think definitely it would be a conversation, a beginning to maybe revisiting some of these economic issues that are going on right now.
Nicolas Maduro's government in Venezuela has arrested Caracas Mayor Antonio Ledezma over allegations of his involvement in a possible U.S.-backed coup attempt. Maduro, who took over from the legendary leftist leader Hugo Chavez, claims that disgruntled military officers are planning a coup of his socialist government in cooperation with opposition politicians. According to VenezuelaAnalysis.com, officials had planned to partake in a bombing spree of strategic targets in the capital. They had hoped this would lead to the assassination of the country's president and bring about regime change. Ledezma's signature on a document calling for a national transition is part of the evidence being cited. So far, the mayor's whereabouts are not known, but other opposition leaders are up in arms over the arrest, saying he was dragged out of his office, quote, like a dog. Now, Christina, it's pretty hard to get unbiased coverage of Venezuela in the mainstream media, but if Ledezma was indeed involved in a coming coup attempt, doesn't Maduro's government have the right to arrest him?
Well, yeah, the simple answer is yes. Venezuela, as a sovereign nation, has a right to arrest someone who they believe was attempting a coup. But I think, you know, we have to put this into context. We don't know if this coup was really U.S.-backed. I mean, it's hard to tell because of the media coverage. As you mentioned, it's really hard to get unbiased media coverage about Venezuela. But we do have to put it into context with previous U.S.-backed invasions and coups in Venezuela, but also other Latin American countries as well. And so sometimes we can start to see, understand why these accusations have some truth to it, even though we might not know all the details. But I do think that one more thing that's important here is that regardless, I know there's going to be cries of human rights abuses from this, but I think there's something to say that the U.S. is going to be somehow involved here or indirectly tied to what's going on. So we always have to come to that that issue as well as U.S. foreign policy. I think that's an underlying current here.
And finally, the New York Times published an op-ed this morning by William Carrigan and Clive Webb entitled, quote, "When Americans Lynched Mexicans," lauding a recent study by the Equal Justice Institute of lynchings of African Americans in the U.S., which we had covered on Uprising. The authors pointed out that additionally, quote, "lynchers targeted many other racial and ethnic minorities in the United States, including Native Americans, Italians, Chinese, and especially Mexicans." In fact, say the authors, quote, "from 1848 to 1928, mobs murdered thousands of Mexicans, though surviving records allowed us to clearly document only about 547 cases. Now, Christina, are you shocked to hear about this little-known aspect of U.S. history? I had never really heard about it on this wide a scale.
Yes, of course, there's always some shock with anytime there's a history about the U.S. that we haven't known, especially on this wide of a scale. But I think also there's less shock because if we really think about the center of what the United States is and the history and the growth of the United States is built off of the bloodshed and violence and conquest of non-white people. And so a history like this about the anti-Mexican violence, and I'm sure if we added the Mexican-American War to that, the numbers would go up. So again, the United States is a nation that's built off of violence and conquest and bloodshed. And so I think we're going to continue to see more stories like this as we continue to dig deeper into U.S. history.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Christina Mislan, for joining us today as our Daily Newsflash guest expert.
Thank you.
Christina Mislan is an assistant professor of journalism studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can now watch Uprising on Free Speech TV, which airs on Dish Network Channel 9415, DirecTV Channel 348, and on hundreds of part-time cable affiliates and on Roku. Within hours of a meeting in Minsk, Belarus last week between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko that resulted in a tenuous ceasefire agreement, clashes broke out once more between rebels and military forces. Pro-Russian separatists have taken control of key eastern cities like Donetsk. The latest fighting, however, has centered around the nearby city of Debaltseve, a strategically important area which is now in control of rebel groups. Ukrainian military forces suffered heavy losses and withdrew from the region. A number of civilians have also been killed. The meeting in Minsk, which was hosted by France and Germany, laid out a series of conditions, none of which have apparently been honored so far. Joining me today is David Marples. He is a distinguished university professor and director of the Stasiuk program for the study of contemporary Ukraine at the University of Alberta in Canada. He's currently visiting Los Angeles, where this program is produced, and joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, why is this part of Ukraine, Debaltseve, considered so important? Is the fate of that city covered in the Minsk agreement?
Well, the city is actually a city. It's a small town, I would say. It's about 25,000 people, and it's located between the cities of Donetsk and Luhansk, almost midway. There's an important road link between the two, but more important is, I think, the rail link. And the rail link is important particularly for the coal industry in this region and for communication between the two cities that are held by the rebels currently, Donetsk and Luhansk. So control of that city for the rebels was considered to be vital. And apparently the issue was discussed for about 8 hours at the meetings in Minsk without any resolution taking place. Neither side could really come to a compromise because, first of all, the rebels were very close to taking it. But with the 60-hour delay between the signing and the actual ceasefire, there probably wasn't enough time to take it. And yet I think pretty well everyone knew they were going to try, including the Ukrainian army, of course, which was determined to prevent it. So that is why I think it never got resolved. And the ceasefire, in effect, was broken almost from the time it started.
Hmm. And so is this battle over this city, Debaltseve, the sort of a final fight to try to secure an important area before the rebels can say, OK, now we're ready to adhere to a ceasefire? Or is it just too late for the ceasefire, for the agreement in Minsk?
Well, there are mixed feelings on this, and some think that, yes, now perhaps a ceasefire can take place. But the rebels also were trying to take the port city of Mariupol on the east coast, which would be a critical link, I think, between this area of Ukraine and Russia, if they could. It would be a very good way to supply Crimea, for example, which at the moment is rather difficult to do. So whether they'll stop there, I'm not sure.
And Crimea, we should remind our listeners and viewers, last year essentially declared that it wanted to join Russia and is essentially lost to Ukraine.
I think it's probably lost for the time being, yeah. Unfortunately, in the case of the Crimean Tatars, which didn't want to join Russia.
And I want to get into some of the details of the popularity of the rebels, et cetera. But in terms of the sort of the ability to bring facts and to find out what is really happening on the ground, it seems as though Poroshenko and Putin are almost getting a different set of facts in what they say to one another and what they say to the press. Are facts hard to come by, or is there a pretty good press corps on the ground?
Well, it's a war, and I think in war, truth is always the first casualty on both sides. And we've seen evidence of almost outrageous propaganda sometimes and things that couldn't possibly be true.
On both sides?
On both sides. And I think Poroshenko really would like to believe what his army commanders are telling him, but it's not always accurate. These army commanders are more or less holdovers from the Soviet period, and many of them are very corrupt and inefficient, which is why I think there are so many volunteer battalions on the Ukrainian side fighting against the separatists.
So what you're saying is that there are sort of actually paramilitaries in Ukraine, not necessarily just the Ukrainian formal military that's fighting the rebels?
Yeah, I think actually there's a real danger that the Ukrainian forces could split into two factions. Because there is so much frustration among some quarters of Ukraine with what the army is doing, how it's being led, and the disastrous military encounters. It's not only Debaltseve. Before that, there was Ilovaisk last August, when there was a massacre that took place because of encirclement, and then Donetsk airport, which supposedly was firmly held and fell to the rebels several weeks ago.
What do we know about civilians living in areas controlled by the rebels? Are they safe, first of all, and are they by and large supportive of the rebel groups?
They're not safe, and in fact the population of the rebel-held region has gone down dramatically since the war began. It's about half of what it was.
So people are fleeing?
People are fleeing both to Russia and to other parts of Ukraine.
And so explain for our listeners and viewers the sort of ethnic breakdown, if there is a, you know, if there are differences in how ordinary civilians are viewing staying with Ukraine versus what they see might see as Russian interests. Does it split along ethnic lines?
Not really, no. This is a region that's been a little bit disaffected from Ukraine from the very beginning. In fact, in
the eastern part, yeah.
The eastern part, which is actually more than the rebels hold right now. It's much broader. But in 1991, this region was promised autonomy by the future Ukrainian president, Leonid Kravchuk, and never got it. It's a proud region, and most opinion polls suggest that it wants to remain in Ukraine. The last thing they wanted was a Russian invasion, but it's very much opposed to the government of Ukraine. So this is where the difference lies. It would much prefer to be autonomous, not to be part of Russia, not to be part of to be part of Ukraine, but to have its own right to run its own economy, sell its coal and steel.
And so the rebels who are holding Donetsk, for example, where do they stand? Are they sort of separate then from this desire to have autonomy from both sides? Are they much more pro-Russian?
Yes, they're much more pro-Russian, and in some cases they are Russian. It's a combination of both, and the rebel leadership has changed from Ukrainians back to Russians who come directly from Moscow, and now once again Ukrainians are in the prominent positions. I mean, the leader of Donetsk, Zakharchenko, is a coal mining engineer. But his predecessor was directly from Moscow. And the same thing in Luhansk. They had Russian leaders, and now they have a military guy, a former military guy in Plotnitsky, who is never seen out of army uniform. It's more or less, you know, like you've got military control over these cities.
Is the United Nations playing a role here? The Security Council did adopt the Minsk deal. Ukraine has called for UN peacekeepers to enforce that deal. But Russia is one of the five permanent members of the Security Council, which may complicate things.
It does complicate things. And so far, the UN has not played a decisive role in this crisis because of that. Russia generally disagrees with the motions put forward by the Americans, for example.
So then what about this other organization, that sort of a Europe-wide monitoring mission, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is in Ukraine? Is this an agency that has a role to play beyond monitoring, or is it strictly sort of monitoring for human rights abuses?
It's strictly monitoring, and they're rather thin on the ground. The last I read, they only had about 300 people working there. They probably need about 2,000 or 3,000 in order to do this monitoring properly. They don't have any kind of military backup whatsoever. And quite often they've been prevented from going into the conflict zones, as yesterday in Debaltseve, for example.
Now, David, what is the importance of this conflict to the stability of Europe as a whole? How serious is this issue? Because we're not talking about a geographically very large place in Europe.
I think it's pretty vital for the reason that the Europeans were trying to bring Ukraine into their community as an associate member. This association agreement wouldn't have even been feasible 10 years ago. It's a product, really, of the what was called the Eastern Partnership Project that was brought in 2009 and includes six countries on the European borders, including Ukraine. And Ukraine was considered one of the best prospects because of its size, because of its central position in Europe. On the other hand, you've got this very intricate and tight relationship between Germany and Russia. It's centered on energy supplies, and I believe the Germans really would like an end to this conflict more than perhaps any other country of Europe, and they would push for that. So Europe is really split down the middle. There are other countries like Slovakia and Hungary which would like to improve relations with Russia too. Other countries are much more firmly on the Ukrainian side, Poland and the Baltic states being the prime example. So the European Union is clearly divided on this issue, and it's difficult to know how to proceed if this peace agreement fails.
What about the role of the United States? The U.S. has been sort of threatening to arm Ukraine for a while now, but in the talks in Minsk last week, the U.S. seemed to have been sort of sidelined in a way that it might not necessarily be seen by Europe as a constructive partner on this. But there are certain members of Congress who are extremely hawkish and would like to essentially see the U.S. directly confront Russia over Ukraine.
Yeah, that's a more difficult one. And I think, first of all, the initiative in Minsk was a German-French one. I don't think the Americans were particularly left out. It's just that the timing of it and the speed needed to come to a settlement precluded direct U.S. involvement. I think the United States also has a difficulty that the president doesn't really want to get involved in this conflict. He said that from the very beginning. And also the question is, if you provide lethal military weapons to the Ukrainian government, what exactly are they going to do with them? How are they going to be trained to use them? What happens if they break down? Will military advisors be sent? There are a number of questions. And most of all, how would Russia respond to an escalation of weapons in Ukraine by the leading country of NATO?
Right, that would be a pretty provocative move. However, having this kind of a conflict gives NATO yet another reason to continue to exist, right?
It does, and in some ways perhaps NATO is very necessary on the border regions. But the question might be, how long can Ukraine hold this region without aid? And if it can't hold it, would it be willing to let it go? And then perhaps the rest of Ukraine join the European structures. That's an option that's never really been discussed in detail, because I think for Poroshenko it would be a kind of death toll as far as his political life is concerned. But in the long term, I think that may end up being the solution if you don't want a frozen conflict in the Donbass.
In the immediate short term, if this ceasefire agreement is not held to, what price does Russia pay if it's seen as continuing to foment a conflict? Will Europe slap more sanctions on Russia?
Yes, I think even Angela Merkel said the same thing today, that they would agree to more sanctions if the agreement fails and Russia is clearly seen to be the violator of the agreement. On the other hand, for Russia can last for quite a while, I think. I mean, it has got enough reserves to last out for perhaps a year. But the fall in oil prices has been disastrous for Russia. And I think Russia would like to see agreement. I mean, Russia's not trying to take over Ukraine here. What it's trying to do is disrupt Ukraine, promote some kind of unrest in an area that's already got civil conflict. You know, there are two conflicts here. One is a civil war. One is a Russian intervention, the problem of a Russian intervention in Ukraine. And they've gone along simultaneously, and sometimes they coincide. But last summer, the rebels were almost defeated last August, and they only survived because Russia stepped in. The question is, there are only 9,000 Russian troops in there, according to Ukrainian sources. With 9,000 troops, you're not going to capture a lot of territory.
Right. And then there are the Ukrainians who would like to not join Russia, nor necessarily stay with Ukraine, as you were mentioning, the sort of civil war aspect, that the two tend to be conflated, at least in most media coverage. Going back to the issue of Russian financial security, just this morning, Russia ratified the $100 billion BRICS Bank that would serve as a fund for infrastructure projects, BRICS standing for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and in a way as a sort of a challenge to the IMF and the World Bank. Can this sort of effort give Russia more independence, at least in the long term?
Well, I think the problem for Russia there is the inclusion of China. Because
which is more a competitor.
Which is more of a competitor, and it will always be seen as a competitor to Russia. Russia needs China, but it doesn't need Chinese influence to a greater extent in Russia. And already in Siberia, there's a lot of Chinese influence, particularly in far eastern cities where Russia can't really improve the infrastructure without assistance from China. So I think that is the problem there. Some of the other countries in BRICS are really not doing so well. So it's a combination of things. I don't think Russia would commit entirely to that. I mean, I think Russia's got European interests first and foremost, and they will remain there. The most important regions for Russia are the former regions of the Soviet Union, and it's never made any bones about that fact. And particularly those that are still outside the EU and NATO.
Which are prime for more Russian influence than they already have.
Well, yeah, I mean, and this is not the first time we've seen this. There's been a frozen conflict in Moldova since 1992. There's a conflict in Georgia since 2008. And now we've got the one in Ukraine. Belarus, for example, is now arming and building up its military force because it's afraid of a Russian invasion there, too. To some extent, I mean, I don't think this is necessarily the case, but Belarus's position has been very ambiguous on the Ukrainian conflict.
Well, David, let's step back and also remind ourselves of the pretty serious human toll of this conflict. Over the past year or more, while this has been playing out, it's not just soldiers that have been killing one another, or rebels that have been killing one another. What has the civilian price been in this conflict?
It's been massive. It's been massive, and both sides are caught in, have had the civilians in the middle. Donetsk, for example, has been shelled by both sides during this conflict, more or less reduced what was really quite a rich city in Ukraine to rubble. Luhansk was never quite as rich. And if you think back not only just a few years ago, 2012 Euro competition was held in Ukraine, and Donetsk was the city that held it. It was the prime city, absolutely ready for this. And also it was the main city of the oligarchs. It's where the president, former president Yanukovych, came from. It's also the home of the richest man in Ukraine, Rinat Akhmetov. So Donetsk really has gone from the richest city in Ukraine to the most desolate. And the population has suffered the most. People have lost, they've got no heating in their homes during this winter. They have no access to clean water. Many have emigrated. And the losses altogether in this war are in the thousands. I mean, the official figure, I believe, is much lower than the reality. The official figure of 5,400 deaths clearly understates the total.
Well, finally, whenever we see media coverage of this conflict, many worry that it might be the beginning of a new Cold War. Mm-hmm. But you've said that Russia doesn't really want to take over Ukraine. Is it overstating it to bring up this fear of a new Cold War?
At the moment, I think it is.
Okay.
If United States does arm Ukraine to a sufficient degree, then we may get the start of something like a Cold War. I don't think we're going to see anything of two power blocks that we saw during the Cold War and the entire world, you know, more or less forced or pushed to join one side or the other. I don't think that's happening. At the moment, it's still confined to a certain region of Europe, and it's not extended outside that region. And I don't think it's likely to do that. You don't really see at the moment. You see Russian pressure on the borderlands, on the Baltic states, on Poland, but you don't really see anything other than small provocations. And I think that's a reflection, really, of Russia trying to look more powerful than it actually is. Russia's not a powerful country economically. The only reason this is a problem is that it's got nuclear weapons. Hmm. Without those nuclear weapons, I think the Ukraine problem will be over tomorrow.
Wow. Well, I want to thank you so much for helping us put all of these issues into context. David Marples, thanks so much for joining us.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
My guest, David Marples, is a distinguished university professor and director of the Stasiuk Program for the Study of Contemporary Ukraine at the University of Alberta in Canada, and he's currently visiting Los Angeles. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. You can now subscribe for direct access to all our shows online at youtube.com/uprising with Sonali. Your subscription sustains the TV production of Uprising. A Texas judge this week placed President Obama's executive action on immigration on hold so that 26 states can commence with a lawsuit. Obama's executive action announced last November could potentially provide temporary relief from deportation for as many as 5 million undocumented immigrants. The governments of Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala announced they were disappointed with the decision. A presidential spokesman in Honduras said the executive action could help to alleviate the social and economic pressures that buffet our countries. And Guatemala's government warned that the resulting confusion of Obama's announcement and the judge's temporary hold could make immigrants more vulnerable to con artists. Mexico's government also expressed disappointment this week with another piece of U.S. news, the police killing of 35-year-old Mexican national Antonio Zambrano Montes, a farm worker in Pasco, Washington. Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to in studio this morning Alejandro Solalinde. He's the coordinator of the South Pacific Human Mobility Ministry of the Mexican Bishopry and director of Hermanos en el Camino, a shelter that provides Central American migrants with humanitarian aid and education. He's a well-known human rights activist and Mexican Catholic priest currently visiting the United States. Also with us in studio to interpret is Miguel Tinker Salas. He's a professor of history and Latin American studies at Pomona College. I want to welcome both of you to Uprising.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, since this this week's news on immigration is so important, let's start with the decision to curb the immigration action that President Obama mentioned. How are Central American migrants in Mexico targeted? What are some of the most serious threats to their safety, which I think our American audience doesn't really know?
Unfortunately, it's very difficult for them to travel through Mexico. Because of organized crime,
but
also because of the hardening of public policy of Mexico, because of Mexican migratory policy.
Ellos han tenido que buscar nuevas rutas.
They've had to find new routes
ante la imposibilidad de subirse al tren.
Because they can no longer get on top of the train known as the beast.
Entonces, no lo dejan subir al
they
tren.
They don't allow them to get on top of the train.
Pasar por camión.
They don't let them pass on trucks.
Entonces, tienen que buscar diferentes caminos.
So they have to find different routes which are more vulnerable, more dangerous,
llegar a Estados Unidos y trabajar.
In order to get to the U.S. and work.
And so in their journey here, who are some of the people that target them? What are some of the threats that they face to their safety, particularly women and children?
Especialmente hijos, niños y mujeres.
Las amenazas siguen siendo el crimen organizado.
The threats come from organized crime.
La alta corrupción que hay en México.
High corruption that exists in Mexico.
De parte de agentes de migración.
Part of agents and migratory agents.
Policías.
Police.
Y de por sí los desafíos del camino.
And especially the challenges they find on the actual trail itself.
La ley es buena.
The laws are good in Mexico.
Una ley de 2011.
We have a 2011 law.
Pero el gobierno impide
the law is not
que
implemented
se
by the government.
Cumpla cabalmente.
It's not implemented.
So, what about the issue of children migrating here
to de hijos, de niños?
The United States? Last year, there was this major problem of Central American children migrating, and the lawmakers here, members of Congress in the United States, vilified them. And these are defenseless, vulnerable children. Did you hear some of the conversations?
Yo quiero ser muy honesto.
I want to be very honest with you
esto,
about this
y
issue.
Que,
and tell you very clearly
que no hay programas ni presupuesto.
There are no programs and there's no budget in Mexico.
Ni de Estados Unidos ni de México,
either from the U.S. or from Mexico,
que puedan detener realmente ese
that
éxodo.
Will actually stop that exodus.
Porque los lugares de origen de las mujeres y los niños,
because the places of origin of both the women and the children, are insupportable.
Por la inseguridad,
insecurity,
por la pobreza,
poverty,
y porque ellos quieren una vida mejor.
And because they want a better life.
Entonces, so, regresan dos niños y dos
so
mujeres,
they can return two or three children,
y van a volver tres.
And three or more are going to come back anyway.
And how did you react to the way in which people see these children as a threat in the United States? I mean, U.S. lawmakers see these children as a big
los jóvenes
problem.
Se miraban como una amenaza.
Los migrantes no son una amenaza.
The immigrants are not a threat.
Ellos no son terroristas.
They are not terrorists.
Son una oportunidad.
They are a great opportunity for the U.S.
En realidad, usted, el doctor y yo somos migrantes.
In reality, all of us are immigrants.
Los migrantes tienen inteligencia.
Immigrants are very intelligent.
Tienen una riqueza muy grande.
They have a great richness,
cultural y espiritual.
Cultural and spiritual richness to share with everybody.
Estados Unidos es un techo muy grande.
The U.S. has a very high level of
que ha recibido a todas las nacionalidades.
All people of humanity.
Ese es Estados Unidos.
That's the U.S.
Es esencialmente migrante.
That's essentially immigrant culture.
Why are Central American migrants treated so badly in Mexico? Some have said that Mexico is an even more dangerous place for Central American migrants than the U.S.
Dicen que México es más peligroso que Estados Unidos.
Porque México está en decadencia.
Because Mexico is in decay.
Porque el gobierno se ha vuelto corrupto.
Because the government is corrupt.
Porque lo que les importa es el dinero.
Because all they care about is money.
Yo quiero decirle que nuestro gobierno engaña al gobierno de Estados Unidos.
Actually, tricks the U.S.
Porque recibe dinero de él.
Because they receive money from the U.S.
No hace lo que promete
con. They do not accomplish what they promise.
Y de todos modos hace negocio con los migrantes.
And even though, then therefore, even taking the U.S.
Los
money, they trick the migrants.
Pasar.
Immigrants also letting them pass.
Pero pagando más.
But making them pay more.
Y gana doble.
So it makes money twice.
El gobierno gana doble. Recibe de Estados Unidos.
It receives money from the U.S.
Y
to stop immigrants.
Recibe de los pobres.
And also takes money from the immigrants to let them pass.
Tell us about Hermanos en el Camino, the shelter that you founded for Central American migrants. Why did you start this
porque
and what sort of work does it do?
Porque fundó el centro.
Porque era necesario hacerlo para brindar seguridad.
It was important to have a base of security
pero
for the immigrants.
También asistencia.
But also help.
Nosotros tenemos 60 albergues.
We have 60 different shelters.
Pero ninguno de nuestros albergues alienta la migración.
But none of our shelters are there to promote immigration.
Nosotros somos muy respetuosos.
We are very
eso.
Respectful.
Cuidamos los derechos humanos.
We respect human rights.
Nada más.
That's all we do.
Y exigimos del gobierno de México.
We demand the Mexican government
que respete la ley.
To respect the law.
Y que respete los derechos
and
humanos.
To respect the human rights.
Que está por encima
that's above everything
de
else.
Cualquier situación migratoria.
That's above every immigration issue.
Has the shelter itself actually been targeted by violent elements and even maybe by police forces?
¿Ha sido el refugio atacado?
Sí.
Yes,
sí.
Yes, it
muchas
has.
Veces ha
many
sido
times.
Atacado.
We have been attacked.
Pero una y otra vez,
but every other time,
Dios nos ha cuidado y
God
hemos salido adelante.
And we've gone forward.
Hoy podemos decir que nuestro albergue es uno de los más seguros de la
we
República
can say today
Mexicana.
That our shelter is one of the most secure in the country.
Es el único albergue donde viven 8 policías.
It's the only shelter where 8 police actually live.
4 policías del estado de Oaxaca.
4 police from the state of Oaxaca.
Y 4 federales que me cuidan.
And 4 federal police that are his bodyguards.
Pero ellos han logrado cambiar su mentalidad.
But they've changed their
de
mentality. As police,
hacer,
to actually
públicos,
to be public servants
de los
that
humanos.
Respect human rights.
So you yourself personally have also been attacked?
¿Usted ha sido atacado?
Sí.
Yes,
muchas
I have.
Veces,
many times.
And I understand you even were forced to go into exile
fuera del país?
Briefly a few years
por
ago?
Tiempo,
por 2 meses.
For 2 months
tuve
I left
que salir
the country.
Porque se juntaron 6 amenazas.
Because there were 6 different threats against my life.
Pero finalmente tuve que volver.
But I had to return anyway.
Porque es mi misión.
It's my mission.
Who would see you as a threat?
¿Quién lo ve como amenaza?
¿Quién? No.
No.
Es decir, el gobierno, número uno.
The government, number one.
El crimen organizado.
Organized crime.
También.
Also.
Políticos.
Politicians.
Que ven en mi actuación.
Who see in my acts.
Un peligro.
A danger.
Porque revelo la verdad.
Because I tell the truth.
Porque denuncio las injusticias.
Because I denounce injustice.
Y porque estoy haciendo visible.
And because I make invisible.
Lo que el gobierno corrupto quiere ocultar.
What the corrupt government would like to hide.
Let's talk about the news issue that has enveloped Mexico in the last 6 months, and that is the story of the 43 missing students from Ayotzinapa. Do you see the, or how do you explain the links between these missing students, the problem of the drug war, as well as poverty and immigration?
Lo que pasa es que, mire,
what happens is the following.
México es un país de muchos contrastes.
Mexico is a country of many contrasts.
Tenemos al hombre más rico del mundo.
We have the richest man in the world.
Pero tenemos 54 millones
de pobres. We also have 54 million people living in poverty.
Estos gobiernos, el que está y los anteriores,
this government and the previous governments,
se olvidaron de la gente
pobre. Forgot about all the people poor.
Entonces tenemos unos indígenas olvidados.
So we have indigenous people who have been forgotten.
Un campo abandonado.
We have a rural area that has been abandoned.
Las mujeres que tienen mucho peligro de ser asesinadas.
Women
cada
who have
día.
The high danger of confronting murder, feminicide.
La gente que está desapareciendo people, por cientos de miles.
People who are disappearing by the hundreds of thousands.
Entonces, lo último que vimos en Ayotzinapa fue un gobierno.
What we saw in Ayotzinapa was a government
sorprendido in fraganti,
caught in the act,
desapareciendo estudiantes,
disappearing students.
Y entonces de repente vemos un
and all
gobierno
of a sudden we see a government
mezclado con el crimen organizado
with organized crime
y confundiendo la autoridad
and confusing authority
con el poder ilegal
with the illegal power that they had.
Eso es lo que vimos.
That's what we saw in Ayotzinapa.
Por eso la gente despertó.
That's why people woke up.
Y nos hemos unido para and reconstruir México.
We have united to reconstruct Mexico.
Pero desde abajo.
From the bottom up.
I understand there's currently a protest that is using Ash Wednesday as a way to campaign for the missing students, smearing their foreheads with the number 43 with ash.
Yo creo que la mayor parte de las personas somos católicos.
The great majority of Mexico is still Catholic.
Y también hay cristianos evangélicos.
And there's also evangelical Christians.
Pero la gente que protesta.
The people who are protesting.
La gente que está herida por
the people who are wounded,
tantas heridas, ¿no?
For so many wounds they have.
Son creativos.
Are very creative.
Y buscaron un símbolo religioso.
And they look for a religious symbol.
Con un reproche del 43.
Which would highlight the 43.
Eso es ser ingenioso.
That's very ingenious.
Y recordar.
And remember.
Que se puede ser cristiano católico.
You can be Christian Catholic.
Pero se tiene que buscar la justicia.
But you have to find justice. You have to struggle for justice.
Yesterday we also heard reports of Mexican teachers attacking a Coca-Cola bottling plant in Guerrero and holding two employees hostage for a few hours.
Atacando una planta de Coca-Cola.
And I'm wondering why are people targeting a company like Coca-Cola? Do you see neoliberal economic policies in Mexico also as part of the same
problem? Tiene que ver la política rural económica en México también.
Yo no tengo nada contra la Coca-Cola.
I have nothing against Coca-Cola.
Pero la Coca-Cola se ve como un símbolo.
But Coca-Cola is a symbol
de el abuso
of the abuse
capitalista norteamericano.
Of the capitalist U.S. abuse.
Es como McDonald's.
It's like McDonald's.
Son símbolos norteamericanos.
They are symbols of U.S. presence.
No del pueblo,
not
de la
people,
nación,
not of the nation,
sino del abuso financiero.
Of the financial abuse that takes place in Mexico.
Now, I understand that you earlier this month participated in a gathering to create a proposal called Refound Mexico. What sort of grassroots organizing is happening to re-envision a new Mexico?
Es un trabajo nuevo.
It's a new work.
Es un trabajo inédito.
It's something that's never been done before.
Que ni el gobierno ni la iglesia católica.
The government or the Catholic Church
han hecho nunca.
Has ever done.
Es decir, unos mecanismos de consulta,
mechanisms of actual sharing information,
de información,
of information,
pero tomar en cuenta a la gente,
but also takes into consideration what people,
a las mujeres,
women,
a los jóvenes,
the youth,
a los indígenas,
the indigenous,
a los campesinos,
the campesinos,
a toda la población,
of all the population.
Por supuesto también a los empresarios,
also it would include industrialists and business people,
de buena voluntad,
and also people who are politicians who have good faith,
es un
and the whole world.
Incluyente.
It's a very inclusive process,
¿sí? Donde todas y todos podemos podemos everybody participar.
Can participate.
Pero donde tenemos que empezar por los últimos.
But we have to start from those who have been forgotten, from those who are below.
Construir un sistema de create a new system participación
of,
ciudadana.
A public citizen participation.
And so let's also go to the fact that the United States plays a huge role, even if Mexico tries to redesign society. You still have to the north this huge
además,
power that is constantly trying to interfere. What do you do about that?
¿Qué hace?
Yo creo que Estados Unidos es nuestro vecino.
The U.S. is our neighbor.
Y la gente, la and nación, es una nación solidaria.
This is very solid. There's a solidarity in the U.S. towards Mexico.
Nuestros hermanos güeros, los anglos.
The white friends, the anglos.
Han estado acompañando la lucha antiesclavista.
Have been there in the struggle against slavery.
Acompañando la lucha de Martin Luther King.
Have been there in the struggle against civil rights and MLK.
De César Chávez.
Of César Chávez.
Ahora se ha solidarizado
and
también
we see solidarity
con Ayotzinapa.
With Ayotzinapa as well.
El pueblo norteamericano
the North
solidario.
American people have solidarity, express solidarity.
Es el poder
fáctico del dinero. What is we have is the real power of money here.
Los que están
the facto power
como
of money.
1%
the 1% who rule.
Que mandan sobre Obama.
Who actually rule over Obama.
Y Obama manda sobre Peña
and
Nieto.
And Obama rules over Peña Nieto.
Y Peña Nieto sobre los presidentes
and
de
Peña
Centroamérica.
Peña Nieto rules over Central America.
Buscando el bien del dinero y no de
so
la
so they're
gente.
Looking for the better amount of money and not the people. That's the fundamental problem.
Let's talk about here in the United States. I mentioned at the beginning the ruling of a judge in Texas to stop Obama's immigration executive action. Does cracking down on immigration actually make a difference to people who are desperate to migrate? Can it stop immigration if you just try to have these harsh enforcements?
Es curioso, pero
it's very curious.
Si uno conoce la historia de Estados
Unidos, if you know the history of the U.S.,
va a ver que se funda al
see,
menos Nueva Inglaterra.
You have the New England.
Se forma, pues, haciendo a un lado, por no decir asesinando.
Assassinating others.
A los nativos americanos.
The indigenous Americans.
Y de hecho los acabaron.
And they almost wiped them out.
Actualmente queda el 1.2%.
Less than 1.2%
de la población norteamericana.
Of the indigenous population.
Entonces,
it remains.
Desde ahí,
from there we see,
han llegado oleadas de migrantes
and from
de
there
todos
we've
lados,
had waves and waves of immigration from all over the world.
Y poco a poco Estados Unidos los
and
ha integrado.
Little by little the U.S. has integrated them.
Lo que pasa con los latinos,
what happens with the Latinos
es que es un bocado difícil de digerir.
It's a different plate to digest.
¿Por qué?
Because
porque no es lo mismo venir de ultramar,
it's not the same thing across the ocean
o de Asia,
or from Asia
a estar al otro lado,
to be the other side of the border.
Porque está México y está Latinoamérica.
Because there's Mexico and there's Latin America at your footsteps, which are in their land, in your language, in your culture, they're part of you.
Y ellos nunca se van a asimilar.
And they're not going to ever fully assimilate.
Pero sí van a formar nuevas culturas.
But they're going to form new cultures.
Entonces ellos son los que son más temibles.
So therefore they fear them more.
Porque son más.
Because there are more of them.
El problema no está en las fronteras.
The problem isn't in the borders.
Sino en las camas.
The problem is in the beds, where they're actually multiplying.
And of course, we have a long history of the border between the U.S. and Mexico being something that has moved and people have moved across the border historically for centuries.
Por siglos.
Finalmente somos hermanos, todos.
Finally, we're all brothers and sisters.
And I'm wondering also in terms of what immigrants here in the U.S. face. Does it shock you in Mexico to hear that this man, Antonio Zambrano Montes, just an orchard picker, was gunned down by police. He was running with his hands up in the air. Mexicans are being killed by police in numbers probably second only to African Americans. Definitely second to
African Americans.
What happens is that violence is violence.
No necesariamente tienen que matar un migrante con una bala.
They don't have to kill an immigrant with a bullet.
También se le mata con la discriminación.
You also kill an immigrant with the discrimination.
Con la injusticia.
With injustice.
El no reconocerlo.
With not recognize them.
El negarle un estatus de ciudadano.
To deny them citizenship.
Son seres humanos.
They're human beings.
Yo me cuestiono mucho.
I always question.
Tantas religiones en
so
Estados Unidos.
So many religions in the U.S.
Y tan poca fe.
And so little faith.
Porque sí, porque rezan mucho, pero
because
no aceptan.
They also they pray
Dios,
an awful lot, but they don't
Dios
accept God.
Because
they don't accept God in their brothers and sisters.
Tell us a little bit about your own journey of faith and how it has
informed
your politics.
Política,
you're not necessarily, I understand, a sort of establishment Catholic
usted no
priest.
Es un padre del establecimiento.
No. Mi personalidad
my personality
y mi riqueza espiritual,
and my ritual, spiritual richness,
yo le he formado con un referente,
I have always formed it with one reference,
que es Jesús,
which is Jesus.
Pero no el Jesús oficial,
but not official Jesus.
Sino el Jesús que está ahí en los evangelios,
but the Jesus is there in the Gospels.
Que es un joven maravilloso,
that is a wonderful youth,
inteligente,
intelligent,
analyst, sensible,
very sensible,
incluyente.
Inclusive.
Entonces,
so
therefore,
I don't follow the example of any pope,
de ningún santo,
of no saint,
de mis obispos,
of my bishops,
y de mis hermanos sacerdotes,
or my other brothers and sisters in the clergy, only from Jesus directly.
Y he visto en él un
and
gran
I have seen in him
humanidad,
a great love for humanity,
un espíritu incluyente,
a very inclusive spirit,
y un luchador indomable
and
por
a
la justicia,
social fighter that never actually gives
por eso,
up.
Yo lucho contra las estructuras
so I fight against structures
que no deben ser en la iglesia
that should not be in the Catholic Church.
Y procuro ser yo mismo
and I tried it myself
y tener el valor de creer
and have the faith
Jesús me ha
like Jesus taught me.
Do you consider yourself as a Catholic also a feminist?
¿Se considera usted como católico feminista?
Uy, totalmente.
Completely.
Sí. Totalmente.
Completely.
Sí. Porque Jesús incluyó
Jesus
a la mujer
included women
en sus discípulos
in his disciples
y la hizo a María Magdalena
and made Mary Magdalene
apóstola.
An apostle.
La iglesia católica no quiere aceptar
the
esto.
Catholic Church does not
pero
want to accept this.
Es la apóstol número 13.
But she is the apostle number 13.
María Magdalena.
Mary Magdalene.
Y nosotros hemos heredado
we have
de
inherited
los judíos un poco
from the Jews
aquella cultura
that culture
excluye a la mujer.
Which initially excluded
pero
women.
Después de 2000 años,
but after 2,000 years,
debe cambiar a la iglesia
we need to change that in the church.
Y algún día tendremos mujeres papas.
And someday we'll have women as popes.
Well, someday. Now, you mentioned earlier the proclivity of immigrant populations to procreate.
El crecimiento de procreación
do
por
you
inmigrante.
Also find yourself differing from the Catholic
se
Church on issues of abortion
rompe con
and
la iglesia
birth
sobre
control
temas de aborto
and the right of women to control
y el derecho
their own
de mujer
bodies?
De controlar sus cuerpos.
Yo creo que el Papa lo ha dicho.
The Pope said.
El Papa Francisco.
Pope Francis.
Nosotros tenemos que ser muy respetuosos
we have to be very respectful
de la decisión de cada
decision
quien.
Of every person.
El aborto no se debe someter a un voto.
Abortion should not be subject to a vote.
Es aprobarlo o rechazado.
It's not a matter of approving or rejecting.
Esto es responsabilidad de cada quien.
It's responsibility of each individual.
No podemos nosotros juzgar a las personas
we cannot
que
judge
tomen
people who make
personales.
Individual decisions based on their personal needs. We have to respect them.
Now, I understand that there's an interesting story behind the cross that you're wearing
me
around your
que
neck.
Hay un interesante cuento sobre esa cruz que está usando.
Sí. Esta cruz la hizo un misionero laico.
A missionary made this cross for
la
me.
Diseñó.
He designed it.
No es una cruz así.
It's not a huge cross.
Mm-hmm. Es una cruz así.
It's a cross that's inclusive.
So it's a cross that has, just for our radio audience, it's got an equal, the sides are equal in length.
The sides are equal, los lados son iguales.
Son iguales, pero se aproxima. Es
but they approximate each other. It's meant to be a hug.
Del Dios que nos amó
the hug, primero. The God that is hugging us.
So it's your interpretation of Christianity.
Es su interpretación de Cristo.
Sí, es Cristo incluyente.
It's an inclusive Christ.
Es el Dios con nosotros.
It's God that's with us.
Que no nos juzga.
That doesn't judge us.
Nos acepta.
Who accepts us who we are.
Como somos.
No matter how we are.
Esto es muy hermoso.
It's very beautiful.
Well, I want to ask you, Alejandro, how your visit to the United States has been accepted by Americans. I mean, of course, there are Americans who express solidarity with the people of Mexico,
claro
but there are still a lot of U.S. Americans who think in terms of black and white, that people should just stay on this side of the border and shouldn't break the law.
No
they see Mexico as a cultural influence, and you might call this racism,
cultural,
that they just don't want here
que
in
no
the country.
Mexicanos acá.
Creo yo que la grandeza de un pueblo
I think the greatness of a people
está en la aceptación de los
in its acceptance of others.
Estados Unidos tiene
the
que
U.S.
reconocer
has to recognize
que su principal riqueza
that its principal richness
es la diversidad
is,
cultural,
is the cultural diversity in its own country.
Pero también la riqueza espiritual.
But also the spiritual richness.
Es una riqueza.
That's,
no,
that's an
no
important richness.
De
it's not something that's going to make you trouble you.
Quien es diferente,
whoever is different
no nos molesta.
Shouldn't bother you.
Es un orgullo.
Should be proud
porque son originales
because they're original and diverse.
And so in terms of you speaking out here, some of the
acá,
issues that you've raised,
algunos temas
are
que usted
people
ha
organizing on this side of the border
hay gente
as well
organizando
in
este lado de la frontera,
collaboration
en colaboración,
with the kind of organizing that you and others are doing
con lo
inside
que usted
Mexico?
Mexico?
Sí.
Of course.
And
sí,
that
sí,
heartens
sí.
you?
Sí, ¿y eso le da orgullo?
Sí, yo me siento muy orgulloso.
I'm very proud.
Porque en México estamos haciendo lo nuestro.
Because in Mexico we're doing our part.
Hay muchas cosas que componer ahí.
There are many things to repair in Mexico.
Pero también la gente que está aquí
but people who are on this side
tiene obligación moral
also have a moral obligation
de componer a Estados
to have to
Unidos.
Fix this country as well.
Yeah.
También.
You also.
Para que sea primero que nada creyente.
First of all, to have faith.
Y segundo, humanista.
To be human.
En tercero,
humanitarian.
Administrador de dinero.
And better administer your money.
So money is always an underlying issue, and we've touched on that several times in our conversations. Here in the United States, economic inequality is becoming a bigger and bigger issue. It's obviously been a problem for a long time in Mexico. How do you envision an economic system that is more in line with people's needs? We've seen, for example, in countries like Venezuela, openly adopting a socialist government. Is that a goal for people in Mexico?
¿Para México también?
Yo no soy economista.
I'm not an economist.
Pero soy pastor.
But I'm a pastor.
Yo creo que si acomodamos las cosas de otra manera,
I think if we fix things another way,
nos va a ir mejor a todos.
It'd be much better for all of us.
Quitar el dinero como Dios.
Take money out of God.
Poner al Dios de la vida en primer lugar.
Put God of life in the first
Luego,
place.
Traer de las orillas a la gente.
And then bring from people who have been marginalized, put them in the center.
Centro.
Put human beings in the center.
Y entonces dale toda nuestra atención,
and then give all our attention,
amor,
all our love.
Invertir todo en él.
Invest everything we have in
para
those people
ser mejores personas,
to make better people,
mejores pueblos,
to make better
mejor.
Peoples and to live better.
Y el dinero y
and
las
money
cosas,
and other objects,
como un medio.
Have be a medium.
Es inmoral que alguien
it's,
piense,
in, it's immoral that someone thinks that someone believes that they're owners of nothing.
Somos administradores.
We are administrators sí. as human
Slim
beings.
Es el hombre más
Carlos Slim, maybe. The richest man in the world, and he will not take $1 with him when he dies.
We also know, however, that the drug lords and the drug gangs inside Mexico, in a way, have the tacit support of the financial elite. We heard, you know, just a few years ago, HSBC, the world's second largest bank, was laundering money from Mexican drug lords. And those are huge powers for you know, ordinary people to have to fight against.
¿Y cómo lucha el pueblo común contra ellos?
No.
No.
No. No. El gobierno... No apoya a los cárteles.
The government does not support the cartels.
Forma parte de ellos.
They are part of them instead.
Y los cárteles
and the cartels
ponen a sus candidatos.
Put, actually run the candidates
Cuando
for the parties.
Uno va a votar,
when you go vote,
elige entre un cartel
you,
y otro.
You decide between one cartel
Porque
and another.
No hay una diferencia entre el gobierno y los cárteles.
Because there's not a difference between the
Esto
cartels and government. This is terrible.
Esto lo pudimos ver en Ayotzinapa.
We could see this in Ayotzinapa.
Por eso la gente está luchando por un cambio.
That's why people are struggling for a change.
Y está como los zapatistas.
Just like the zapatistas.
La comunidad indígena de Cherán,
or Michoacán. Cherán, Michoacán. The indigenous community
Ellos
is organized there.
Tienen su propia policía.
They have their own police.
Administran su dinero.
They administer their money.
Y están organizando su autoridad.
And they're organizing their own authorities.
Como un servicio.
As a service.
No como un poder de
not as, a, not as a power.
And in these autonomous regions... How powerful are the drug lords and the drug gangs? And can these autonomous regions then multiply around Mexico as a way to fight against this violence?
They have to multiply because the narcotraffickers do not have access to these areas. But the parties don't have access either. They are the people's government there. And they're not against the government per se. They are part of the institutions and of the law. But they actually manage
no
it, not the government,
no los partidos políticos
not the political parties that are corrupt.
So that is right there an alternative
Ahí está
model
una alternativa, modelo
that
alternativa.
Ordinary yes. people in communities Pero can begin adopting.
Otra gente puede adoptar.
Es lo que queremos hacer.
That's what we want to do.
Queremos hacer una organización
we want to do an organization
con sentido comunitario,
with a sense of community,
solidario,
solidarity,
seguro,
safe,
y justo.
And just.
Que sea incluyente,
that be inclusive,
donde las mujeres
where women
no sean asesinadas,
are not assassinated,
donde los niños no sean tampoco descuidados,
where the children are not left unattended,
el migrante sea respetado,
where the migrants are respected,
y no haga negocio con el
and
ser
you,
humano.
And you don't do business with human
Eso
beings.
Queremos, una
that's what we want.
Y un gobierno humano.
A society and a government that's humane.
Now, the problems in Central America are also quite similar, where you have the problems of drug violence and poverty that forces people to migrate in the first place. Are there connections that you've made with communities in countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras?
Yes, we have.
Yo he estado visitando constantemente.
I've been constantly visiting.
En un par de meses más,
in a few more months, I will be there again in Central America.
En El Salvador,
in El Salvador,
Nicaragua.
In Nicaragua.
Pero yo puedo ver en ese Centroamérica semi-destruido.
I can see in that semi-destructed Central America.
Los efectos terribles de este modelo
capitalista. I can see exactly the examples of this neo-capitalist system as they have made tremendous damage.
Este modelo tiene que cambiar.
This model has to change.
Porque es injusto.
It's unjust.
Porque está condenando a la gente
because
a morir
it's condemning
hambre.
People to die of hunger.
Y está generando violencia.
And it's generating violence.
Mientras hay este sistema en
as long as you have this system in Central America, people will continue to migrate.
And, you know, given the U.S. role in the coup a few years ago
in
Honduras,
and
given the U.S. role in influencing Mexico, in hearing you speak, I really feel that some of the greatest responsibility lies with Americans in changing the way our government has had a relationship with Latin America.
You're completely correct.
The 20th of May, a las 4 de la tarde,
at 4 o'clock in the afternoon,
de 2012,
in 2012,
estuve en el Departamento de Estado.
I was in the Department of State.
2013, corrijo.
2013, I was wrong.
Estuve en el Departamento de Estado.
I was in the Department, State Department.
Me recibieron personas muy educadas.
I was welcomed by very educated people.
Que me mostraron un rostro humano.
Who showed me a human face.
Y ahí reconocieron lo que usted está diciendo.
And they recognized
Estados
what you're saying.
Estados Unidos tiene responsabilidad.
That the U.S. has responsibility for the weapons.
En la droga.
In the drugs.
Y en quizá no cuidar mucho los derechos humanos.
And not actually taking care of human rights.
Los gobiernos de México,
which the governments of Mexico and Central America violate.
Wow. So finally, how can ordinary people also do direct solidarity from here with those in Mexico and those in Central America? Americans really love to be able to make donations to an organization. Does your shelters accept donations?
¿Su refugio acepta donaciones?
No.
No.
Lo que
no,
yo
we don't.
Pediría,
what I would ask you to do,
hacer,
what they have to do,
is cuidar a los migrantes aquí.
Look after the migrants that are here.
No nos ayuden allá.
Don't help us over there.
Aquí,
help us here.
Luchando por mejores leyes.
Look for better, fight for better laws.
Porque los jueces,
because the judges
y políticos no
and,
sean north of,
and politicians
ellos.
Not discriminate against immigrants.
Eso nos puede ayudar.
That's what you can do, help us.
Well, that is a perfect note for us to wrap up this conversation. I want to thank you so much.
Muchas gracias,
for
padre.
Us
Muchas
today.
Gracias.
It's been
gracias,
a wonderful padre. Conversation. Thank you so much. My guest, Alejandro Solalinde, is a well known human rights activist and Catholic priest from Mexico. Miguel Tinker Salas, a heroic interpreter, professor of history and Latin American studies at Pomona College. This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Alexander Hobbs is our technical director. Christian Beck is our production assistant. And Federico Garcia and Jonathan Alexander are our audio engineers. Camilo Ramirez is our sound editor. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you on Monday.